Options were paid out at a generous number, but they had gotten lucky by reason of making good connections to start with. Some people look at networking of that sort as being slightly disreputable, as if they're stealing an advantage they don't really deserve. And sometimes it can make you feel a little queasy. When the HBO show Girls was first announced, I remember being a little taken aback by the cast. Creator Lena Dunham had selected three women to co-star with her, and two of them, Allison Williams and Zasha Mamet, had famous parents, and the third, Jemima Kirk, was Dunham's high school friend. All were talented, but I kept thinking about all the equally talented young actresses who didn't have their edge. I pictured rows of young actresses standing in line for their audition, not knowing the odds were stacked against them. It didn't seem fair. But then a funny thing happened. Over six seasons on the air, Williams and Mamet and Kirk so defined their characters that it was impossible to think of anybody else in their roles. Mamet continued honing her skills, and I went to see her in an off-Broadway play in which she was stunningly good. And that's when I realized connections can give you a foot in the door, but just like any other lucky break, what really matters is what you do with them. Still, the networks and weak ties that make luck for some people effectively block the path for others. In terms of social mobility and possibilities for everyone, we need to think about ways to distribute opportunities equitably in work and finance and entertainment. And some people are doing exactly that. My friend Julian Johnson is the Executive Vice President of Sponsors for Educational Opportunity, SEO, a nonprofit that offers career programs for students from underserved communities. If you want that job at Goldman Sachs but come from a poor town in southern Alabama, Julian might be your guy. Over the years, he and his colleagues have helped thousands of minority students land jobs in finance and law and investment banking. "We help create networks for people who don't have them," Julian told me. Minority students at small schools, for example, might not have any obvious route to Wall Street, since investment banks usually offer jobs to students from only a few select colleges. But SEO makes the network much wider. You provide the hard work and determination, and they'll make sure you get the opportunities to connect with the right people. When Julian and I spoke, SEO had students from 105 different colleges about to start in summer internships. That's a large number of schools. SEO was opening lucky doors for a lot of people, and they expected that 80% of the interns would get full-time offers. Julian pointed out that to make luck in your career, you need to do more than study and work hard. That might have paid off in grades K through 12, but in the real world, it's no longer enough. Instead of keeping your head down and expecting the work to speak for itself, you need to find mentors and advisors and sponsors who will help you advance. Julian told me that the SEO teams stay with the students after they get the internships to help them understand how to ascend within the company. Because, as he said, your network becomes your net worth. Personal channels open unexpected paths, and wherever you start in life, you owe it to yourself to develop and take advantage of them. You have to give yourself a fair shot. Whether it's your dad, or a hairdresser, or a varsity teammate some years removed, or an organization like SEO, opening your networks changes your luck. My friend David E. Dell has been thinking about luck in careers for a long time now, at least in part because he knows that he's the guy who sometimes delivers it. As the head of DRG, an executive search firm that deals mostly with nonprofit organizations, he has placed more than 1,000 top executives in their jobs. To find them, he has approached tens of thousands of people who weren't expecting to hear from him at all. David and his wife, Marcia, happen to live across the street from me in Manhattan. So one rainy evening, I crossed the street and joined him for a drink in his pretty apartment. As an executive recruiter, David told me that he knew how surprising it could be to some people when they heard from him. "I'm the random phone call, the guy who calls and says, 'Hi, I have this good opportunity and thought you might be interested,'" David said with a smile. "You have just come back from lunch and weren't thinking about changing jobs, and now I present an opportunity that you had no clue even existed. So the question is, what do you do when that drops into your lap?" From long experience, David has found that people typically fall into one of three categories. He described the first group as people who throw up 100 defenses right away as to why it won't work. Sometimes the problem is real life getting in the way of opportunity. If your teenager is a junior in high school, you may not want to move. And sometimes they're just uncomfortable with change. People in the second group are also slightly wary and show it by digging in and asking a lot of questions. Who they'll report to, why the last guy got fired, what their responsibilities would be. They want all the information before deciding whether to even have the conversation, David said. Then there's the third group, the people who listen and say, "Great, I wasn't expecting your call, but I'm in." David finds the initial response to be a good measure of how the person will do going forward. The naysayers in the first group usually won't work out even if they change their mind and decide to pursue the opportunity. Those in the second group who ask a lot of questions may be thoughtful and analytic, and David appreciates that. But he's also careful to see if they're the kind of people who will continue to throw obstacles in the way and find reasons not to go ahead. Those in the third group are most likely to be successful at recognizing new and lucky opportunities, but he wants to be sure that they're not reckless. Luck comes to the people who have the courage to recognize an opportunity when it arises and are open to thinking about how to operationalize it, he said. David had his own experience with an unexpected opportunity very early in his career when he was working as a fundraiser for a very large nonprofit organization. And then the craziest thing, I got a call from Citizen Watch Company asking if I'd teach their salesman how to sell watches. I was 30 years old and didn't know a thing about watches. One of the top executives had seen him in action as a fundraiser, knew he was persuasive and good on his feet, and recommended him. So I went to the Acapulco Princess in Mexico for 5 days with my wife and did sales training for a $75 million watch company. Courageous? Okay, yes. Lucky that it came my way and I didn't screw it up? Definitely. It was always a reminder for me going forward that when you have opportunities, you take them, David said. David continued leading those sales trainings for several years and began to see opportunities for himself outside fundraising. Taking an expansive view of his own career, he made the leap to start his own executive search firm. From his own experience, he encourages people to have a general sense of what's on their radar, but not to be too focused on exactly what they want. Creating luck doesn't mean taking every opportunity, but it does mean that you have to be open to exploring whether yes or no is the right answer, he said. He doesn't mind pursuing a possibility with someone and ultimately getting a well-reasoned no. He's very respectful when people present him with the specifics of why they're turning down one opportunity and can explain what it would take instead for their next step. The other side of that is adopting a willy-nilly strategy, so the next call you get is the next job you take, he said. That leaves you depending on randomness rather than generating any real luck. A call from David, or someone like him, can seem like the ultimate out-of-the-blue bolt of good luck. But to David, it's not random at all. Someone has told David that a particular person is worth meeting. When I'm doing a search, I rely on people to tell me about the talented people they've encountered. I'll hear, "Oh, you should meet Joe because he's doing interesting stuff." Or, "I heard him speak at a conference and he was really good." The things you do create the opportunities, David said. You can advance your professional profile and get noticed by speaking at conferences or being part of committees or writing interesting papers or blogs. David doesn't think of it as networking as much as enhancing your profile and letting the world know about the good work you're doing. But shouldn't good work speak for itself? Sometimes it does, David said with a smile. I might hear that somebody has been doing interesting work, so I'll call them. But then they have to speak about the work, right? They have to want the opportunity and take the next step. Barnaby and I chatted about the jobs we'd each had over the years, and we were surprised to realize that between us, we had hardly ever applied for a job. We didn't have to worry about the tossed resumes problem because we'd never really submitted resumes. We'd always taken an alternate way around. My career had followed a one thing leads to another pattern. Many times an executive I worked with in one job asked me to come with her to another, and I did. It wasn't carefully planned, but sometimes the best way to make a career and a happy life is to recognize opportunities when they come and grab them. When I first got a job as a TV producer, I didn't even own a TV. Barnaby always created his own lucky directions and took even less traditional routes. His parents were both risk-takers who retired early from executive posts and moved to Alaska with their five children. When he was about 7 or 8, Barnaby lived with his family in the middle of the woods, with no clocks or calendars, no electricity or running water. He spent a lot of time relying on himself and watching out for bears. He couldn't rely on standard paths because there weren't any. He had to find his own solutions. Barnaby told me that his first real job before college was with Disney, and he certainly didn't find it online. Back then, he thought it would be exciting to study the behavior of unusual birds. So he went to visit the curator of Discovery Island, a precursor of Disney's Animal Kingdom theme park, and asked if he could study the varieties in their collection. No such job existed, Barnaby said, but I was sufficiently excited about the idea that the director made up a position for me on the spot. Barnaby's first research was on a large bird called the brush turkey, which comes from the deep rainforests of northeastern Australia and spends its time scraping dead leaves into a giant compost mound. The leaf compost generates heat and can then be used as a nest. Clever, right? Studying compost may not sound like your dream job, but Barnaby was so passionate about his work that he became a popular character at the wildlife park. He even became the subject of a coloring book the park used. Keeping his luck going, Barnaby announced that he was curious about the behavior of vultures. He wanted to follow those residing at the park. And why not? Disney arranged for him to use a private airplane that was specially fitted with radio tracking devices. I'd like to say you can't make this stuff up, only you can make it up. That's the whole point about creating your own luck. As a little side note, Barnaby told me that Walt Disney himself understood about making your luck. He failed many times in business, but never gave up. Early on, Walt applied for a position as a postal clerk and was rejected as too young. He came back, dressed better, and having penciled in a shadow of facial hair. He got the job. Another time, Walt was fired from a job because someone said he lacked imagination and had no good ideas. If you want to get lucky, you persist. You create your own magic kingdom. Personalized jobs come when somebody trusts you and is willing to take a flyer on an original idea. Some years ago, I got a job that had never existed before, creating television shows for a popular magazine brand. I spent 5 happy years in the role. One of the shows I produced was a multi-year TV award special that attracted some of the biggest names in television at the time. In one of my favorite personal pictures from the first year of the show, my husband and I are walking down the red carpet. He's handsome in black tie, and I've been decked out by a publicist in a borrowed designer dress that shimmers in the lights and $1 million worth of diamonds on loan from a store on Rodeo Drive. Talk about luck. A perfect way to get lucky is to follow a passion and make up your own position, Barnaby said. My older son, Zach, got the concept of making your own luck when he was still in school and attended a campus talk by the president of an online payments company. Zach went up to the executive afterward, said how much he admired the company, and asked if they could get together. The president agreed to a meeting, but just to give advice and information. He didn't have any openings for a student with Zach's background. Zach came to the meeting well prepared. Always a way to make yourself lucky. But he also listened carefully. As the president described how they were trying to reach customers, Zach offered an idea on how collecting and analyzing a certain kind of data might be helpful. The president nodded thoughtfully. He hadn't thought about that approach before, and he asked if Zach might be able to do it. "Yes, I'd be excited to take it on," Zach said. "Can you start this afternoon?" the president asked. "Happy to," Zach said. You don't have to worry about your resume being tossed away if you're sitting with your would-be boss and solving a problem for him. Having something very specific to offer changes an answer from "can't use you" to "can you start this afternoon?" Working at this very cool company looked to Zach's friends like the ultimate in good luck, but it was luck that he had made. Proud of my kid? You bet. Wanting to avoid the vagaries of randomness, more and more people are trying to make luck by going in their own direction. Sometimes the best way to end up in the third stack is to be in a spot where those first two stacks don't even exist. Or, as a very successful friend of ours put it, people always talk about thinking outside the box. I never even knew the box existed. In an increasingly entrepreneurial world, the barriers to entry in most fields keep getting lower. You can now create a company with a laptop instead of a factory. So abandoning standard career paths and making your own trail isn't crazy. It could be one way of entering the good luck club. Barnaby suggested I meet a young woman named Rebecca Kantar, who is a master of going her own way and creating luck. In her mid-20s, she was already a serial entrepreneur. So one afternoon, we headed over to the offices of the Gerson Lehrman Group, GLG, where she sometimes works. It was one of those super chic spaces where you immediately feel that everyone around must be cooler than you. The front area featured red and orange chairs in a flex space, an upside-down fish tank, and hanging lights in the shape of brass globes. Behind the cool spaces were rows and rows of people on computers. Smiling, Kantar came out to greet us. Slim and graceful with long blonde hair and a beguiling style, she could have easily passed for a high school cheerleader. But she's not, and never was. When we sat down at a corner table, Kantar quickly admitted that she's always been an original, going in her own direction. She surprised everyone a few years ago when she decided to drop out of Harvard after her sophomore year. She considered it a good way to get lucky. The average income for Harvard dropouts is higher than for Harvard graduates, she said briskly. Barnaby suggested that maybe the average was being skewed by the outsized fortune of Harvard dropout and Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Yes, Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and Matt Damon were all Harvard dropouts who raised the average, Kantar said. She liked to see herself in their mode. She, too, wanted to be an original who took big risks and looked very lucky when they paid off. When she was at Harvard, she hadn't felt inspired by her classes and didn't see where her degree would lead. My parents were panicked, but I tried to talk them through and ask what they were worried about, she said. My mom pointed out that I wouldn't be able to get a traditional job in investment banking or consulting without a college degree. But I said I didn't want one. She also worried about what would happen if I eventually wanted to go into politics. I said that my generation would like to see someone who had done something interesting rather than just what's expected. Kantar had gone in her own directions from an early age. Growing up in suburban Newton, Massachusetts, she took Chinese, got obsessed with origami, and played the trumpet. For her bat mitzvah, she took her friends snow tubing. I hated dance parties. And later, in middle school, she started asking her baffled parents for a donkey. I thought it would be nice to have one in the backyard. No particular reason. I liked donkeys, Kantar said with a smile. Trying to avoid a bigger argument, her parents explained that their suburban home wasn't zoned for farm animals. Kantar was too young to drive, so she walked over to City Hall one afternoon and filed a petition for rezoning. She got it, but she still didn't get the donkey. The donkey story pretty much summed up Kantar's attitude. Go after things that are different. In high school, she didn't want to take the standard classes and asked to devise her own curriculum. The school said no. So she wrote to the deans of the Ivy League schools where she had applied and said she wanted to quit her AP classes and do an independent study project for the rest of the year. What did they think of that? Most of them responded that it would be just fine. Rebecca spent the rest of senior year outside the classroom. It was the best academic experience I had, she said. While she was still at Harvard, Rebecca developed a company called Brightco, which connected young entrepreneurs with corporations and investors who could use their insights. The idea was that the younger group knew about innovations that might upend the traditional models. Coca-Cola might not know that some 20-year-olds were developing a sprayable caffeine that could completely disrupt their business, Kantar explained, so we put them together. The company was still small when Kantar dropped out, and she knew it would never be Facebook. But eventually, GLG made an offer to buy it. GLG has become hugely successful by connecting experts with the business people and investors who want their information. They were really buying Rebecca's brain and gave her the title of Entrepreneur in Residence. Kantar is now developing a company to change how testing is done for both colleges and employment. She is convinced that the standard tests currently being used, whether IQ tests or SATs or personality analyses, don't find the original thinking that is most important for success. People who are pointy-headed or jagged in some way are the ones who create big, lucky change, she said. You have to let them go their own way. We need sheep in the world, but when you find the black, eccentric sheep, let them be blacker. Kantar recognizes that going along a standard path puts a floor on bad outcomes. If you go to Harvard, the worst that can happen is you become a cog at an investment bank, she said. But dropping out creates a huge possibility tree, for better or worse. When we left, Barnaby told me that a few months earlier, he was at an elite conference of innovators that Kantar told him she wanted to attend. He made inquiries with the organizers on her behalf, and when she didn't get one of the coveted invitations, she still found a way to get inside. I was impressed. Even though Kantar looked like a cheerleader, she apparently had the ferocity and intensity of a Navy SEAL. When she had a mission, she didn't let anything get in her way. When someone is an original, you never know what will happen. Kantar could end up being the next Steve Jobs, or she could end up with no jobs at all. Trying to crash the party, you sometimes just crash instead. Being willing to take unusual risks is one more way you can get lucky in a job. Sometimes it pays off big, and sometimes it doesn't. Yet failing isn't always a bad thing. Barnaby told me about a conversation he had with Naveen Jain, the entrepreneur who founded a company called InfoSpace in the late 1990s. It was briefly one of the largest internet companies in the country, making Jain worth some $8 billion. Then came the dot-com crash and a series of lawsuits, and suddenly his stake was more in the $200 million range. Failing is part of becoming good, Jane told Barnaby when they talked recently. In basketball, the best player on the best day will only score about 50%, and the other 50% aren't considered failures, but part of the success. Fail well. Interested in space exploration, Jane co-founded a company in 2010 called Moon Express, trying to be the first to land a robotic spacecraft on the moon and send back images. He has secured a launch contract with NASA. Life depends on your outlook, Jane said. For any new venture, you think, what can happen and what could be possible? This prepares you for both good luck and bad luck, which are going to be coming in the future. Jane was convinced that going in your own direction requires some risks, but once these are analyzed, they may not be as dramatic as they seem. In his view, for example, having a private company try to get to the moon wasn't crazy at all. For space travel, government tries to eliminate 99.99% of risks because failure is not a political option. The last 1% of the risk abatement adds 99% of the cost, he said. A private company can make the unmanned rocket good enough, then buy private insurance to cover the cost if something goes wrong. Jane sees that as a metaphor for how to lead other pursuits. Forgo making it absolutely as safe as possible, he said. Nothing is ever 100% safe anyway. You have to know yourself and your willingness to take risks. Barnaby and Rebecca Kantar are probably the types who would climb on Jane's spaceship and see where it took them. I'm not sure I would. I'm willing to get lucky through making the right connections, working hard, and taking opportunities, but I'm not a big risk taker. Some people will probably get a lot luckier with a willingness to try a completely unknown approach. Trying to get lucky by going your own way doesn't work every time, but when it does, you end up with one of those stories showing the value of being original. So, for example, Barnaby didn't drop out of college like Kantar did, but he did switch university several times, moving from Harvard to Cornell to a year of research at Oxford. He actually planned it all, wanting to work with the world-renowned ornithology professors at each. Later, he wanted to win a Rhodes Scholarship to return to Oxford and needed to be endorsed by his school. Cornell initially said they couldn't support him because he didn't have enough credits on their campus. Barnaby went higher and higher in the administration, finally banging on the president's door. He figures that he contacted close to 50 people in various capacities to get support for his application. It wasn't the standard approach, but in this case, being original made me stand out, Barnaby told me. I met a lot of people, and some of them even became new friends. Whether you want to get to the moon or win a Rhodes Scholarship or land a job at Goldman Sachs, you get lucky when you make your own path. Sure, some randomness can come into play, but you'll expect that ahead of time and do everything to work around it. You'll put yourself in the third resume stack instead of one of the others that might be tossed away. You'll speak to the right people, find your own direction, and be willing to stand out. It won't work every time, and you might get a chance to learn from your failures. But when it does, you'll look very, very lucky. Chapter 11. Get Lucky in Love. Don't expect a supermodel to make you lucky. Invest in the relationship. Look for love in new places. Pick the right grazing ground. My husband and I recently marked a big anniversary with a dreamy trip to South Africa. We stayed one night at a glorious hotel called the Quartier Français and indulged in a 9-course dinner, yes, 9 courses, in a famed restaurant called the Tasting Room. Over crazy good food, we held hands, stared moonily at each other, and talked about our amazing good luck. We still made each other laugh, shared the same sense of adventure, all those lions and rhinos in Africa, and had been great partners in raising our 2 terrific sons. It was probably enough to make anybody overhearing us want to throw up. But it wasn't until much later that I thought about how we had gotten so lucky. Was it random chance that I had stumbled on the perfect guy all those years ago? Out of 7 billion people in the world, had I somehow found at age 24 the one person destined to be my soulmate? I wish I could be that romantic. Sure, Ron was handsome and fit, and as a doctor he had a kind, caring style that I admired. But as I suspected after all the research I'd been doing, our luck in love had less to do with the magic of meeting the right person than with the effort we had put in afterward. Nicholas Sparks would never sell a book if he wrote about the nitty-gritty that makes a good marriage. Turning the other cheek when one person is snitty and turning to the other side of the bed when the other person is snoring. But ultimately those are the twists and turns that make others think it was all just good luck. Most of us are realistic about what it means to be lucky in love. In the national survey Barnaby and I conducted, only 7% said that you needed to find the perfect person. The very largest number, a full 80%, said that the secret to being lucky in love was to pay attention to the other person's needs as much as to your own. Back home over a more normal 1-course dinner, grilled chicken and vegetables, I asked Ron what he thought had made us lucky in love. Probably Netflix, he said. Netflix? I asked, puzzled. Right, we can never find anything to watch, because you're trying to pick something I'll like and I want to pick what you'll like. It cuts down on how many movies we see, but it's why we feel very lucky with each other. I liked that explanation. When you let the other person's desires ride as high in importance as what you want, and your partner does the same, you both feel loved and lucky and supported. Ron's definition of lucky in love matched our survey. But there are some bold names who would contribute a different view. On his first solo album in 1985, Mick Jagger roared out a song called Lucky in Love. For the racy rock star with the wandering hips, the song was a fairly obvious way to boast about sexual conquest. He might be unlucky as a gambler with cards, horses, roulette, and craps, but he could crow that with women it was easy. Yes, I've got the winning touch, he bellowed. Jagger is one of those guys who, in the teenage parlance, get lucky on a regular basis. Model Jerry Hall hung around to have 4 children with him, even though she knew he was unfaithful from the beginning. He has fathered a host of children with 6 different mothers, and has managed to keep the sex symbol moniker well into his 70s. He's clearly lucky at sex, and if he says he's lucky at love, we believe him. But Jagger's definition of luck isn't shared by as many people as you may think. Soon after our trip to South Africa, I was on a book tour stop in Iowa and met a woman named Phoebe, who told me that she had been married to her high school sweetheart, Al, for more than 40 years. The two of them had never been with anyone but each other. Or so she said. I didn't press. Nobody could be luckier than me, Phoebe said, reaching over to take his hand. Her adored husband was slightly balding, with a belly that spilled over the top of his khaki shorts. They didn't have any children, but they had a mostly blind and beloved German shepherd and a little cabin on a lake 2 hours away that they retreated to on warm weekends. The love nest? I asked, teasing. No, just a cabin that's falling apart, she said with a little smile. An accountant, Al had lost his job a couple of years earlier and was working from home as a consultant. He doesn't get a lot of work, but I still have my job as a nurse, and we manage just fine, she said. Adding up all the elements, the lost job, the schlumpy appearance, and the falling apart cabin, it occurred to me that at least superficially, some people might think Phoebe wasn't so lucky in love after all. But Phoebe was dedicated to Al and had a way of looking for the good in him. Focusing on the positive and giving lots of love and support made them both feel lucky. Phoebe had clearly found a formula that esteemed psychologist Barry Schwartz would immediately understand. A lucky relationship is created, not discovered, Dr. Schwartz said when Barnaby and I called him one morning. A longtime professor at Swarthmore, Dr. Schwartz became nationally known for his surprising research on the paradox of choice. He popularized it with a book of that name and many TED Talks. He showed that while we think having many choices will make us happier, it actually leaves us less satisfied. When you have too many options, you're always thinking about the alternatives that you passed up. Dr. Schwartz joked about how happy he used to be years ago when his local store offered only one kind of jeans. Then along came choices like slim fit, easy fit, relaxed fit, button fly, stone washed, acid washed, and on and on. Now, when he leaves the store, the jeans fit much better, but he feels much worse. Adding options increases expectations, which, he said, produces less satisfaction with results, even when they're good results. What's true for jeans is equally true for spouses. If you're looking to find the best, you're never going to put in the time and effort to make what you have the best, he told us. It's the Tinder effect. Why invest the time and commitment necessary to make a relationship grow when another option is just a swipe away? Married for more than 50 years, Dr. Schwartz has been investing in his own marriage for a long time. We've known each other a lot longer than that. She was my best friend in eighth grade. So she doesn't like it when I talk about finding a spouse who is good enough, he said with a laugh. But really, that's what you want. Phoebe might similarly object to the idea that her husband is good enough. But it's pretty clear that whatever his traits, she got lucky in love by investing effort and taking positive actions, including holding hands, sharing smiles, and visiting that cabin. Like Dr. Schwartz and his wife, Phoebe and Al met when they were young, in high school in their case, and they have stayed close to their hometown. Living in a small town, you have fewer options, so you're more likely to be of the mindset to find someone and see what you can make of it, said Dr. Schwartz. You don't have as many distractions. Nobody likes the idea of settling for a spouse, but Dr. Schwartz points out that we're usually lousy at knowing how to evaluate potential mates anyway. After all these years, he knows that his wife is kind, empathetic, and intelligent, and has a fierce moral core. Plus, she's the great first reader for everything he writes. But he didn't focus on any of that when they met. I was attracted to her because she was the first girl I ever met who loved baseball, more specifically, the New York Yankees. Liking the damn Yankees, what kind of basis is that for a relationship? Obviously, it was a good one, or good enough. If you get your lucky in love ideas from Hollywood romantic comedies, you would probably focus the script on the beginning of the story. Barry and Myrna meet as kids and become best friends. He works hard to make her his girlfriend, and eventually they get married. Music plays, fade to black, end of story. But the luck of their marriage wasn't made the day they met or the day of the wedding ceremony. That was really the beginning of the story, not the end. The real relationship developed in the following years as they trusted each other and turned to each other for support and love. You always hear people say, oh, they're so lucky they found each other. But no, really, they found each other and turned it into something others wanted. That luck happens much more often than kismet, said Dr. Schwartz. The fantasy version can make for the unluckiest relationships around, because when you focus only on the days leading up to the wedding, you forget to think about what happens afterward. And it's in that afterward when the marriage and the real luck of love kicks in. A successful financier I'll call Troy thought he was the luckiest guy in the world when he started dating a Victoria's Secret model. His friends were appropriately wide-eyed and jealous. Dating a gorgeous woman known for posing in a bra and panties could provide the ultimate opportunity for a Mick Jagger-like chance to swagger, I'm so lucky, I'm so lucky. The luck continued, or so it seemed, culminating in a yummy wedding much shared on social media. But then real life kicked in. It's a good bet that a guy who dates a knockout beautiful model, we'll call her Helen, is a type A high testosterone sort who likes to be the center of attention. Troy could strut all he wanted in the bedroom, but when they went out in public, he suddenly found himself regularly pushed into the background. Photographers wanted to get shots of Helen on the red carpet. And could he please step aside? There was always a flurry when they walked into a chic restaurant, but again, all eyes were on her, not him. He found himself resentful of how long it took her to get ready to go out, the amount she spent on clothes, and the fact that she seemed slightly more in love with herself than with him. The luck ended with a very expensive divorce. When you think about being lucky in love, you need to have a longer view than just the thrill of walking down the aisle. The person who is fun to date may not be the one who will make you feel loved and lucky in the good times and bad that come into everyone's life. The wedding industry may be the unluckiest thing that has happened to love. Expensive bands and flowers don't do anything for a happy marriage. Once again, talent, in this case the ability to be kind and forgiving, and hard work, are at play in making luck. But what about the random chance of meeting your future mate in the first place? If you're single, finding the right person to marry can seem like an endless minefield. Helen Fisher, the biological anthropologist who has become one of the world's experts on love, met Barnaby and me one morning for breakfast to talk about dating and getting lucky in love. Blonde and slim, Fisher has been at the love game for a long time, but she has the huge energy and glowing skin of someone half her age, and she's still excited by love. You're trying to win life's greatest prize, which is a life partner and a chance to send your DNA to the future, she said, munching on a healthy bowl of fresh fruit. But going out on dates can feel like a job and it takes work. You have to dress up and be charming and have clean hair. Fisher is a research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and has an academic appointment at Rutgers University. But she currently gets a lot of attention for being the chief scientific advisor to the website Match.com. Everyone who talks to her wants to know how technology has changed love. And while she says that 40% of singles have dated somebody they met online, she's adamant that technology can't change love at all. The brain is powerfully built to find love, and anthropological studies tell us that 90% of any interaction is nonverbal. When you're with someone, the ancient human brain will click in and tell you if it's right, she said. So despite being paid well by online dating sites, she says her first rule for getting lucky is to get out and connect in person. I don't care whether you first meet at a church or a Starbucks or online, the only real algorithm is your own brain, she said. She shares Barry Schwartz's position that too many choices can undermine love. Stay online too long and you get overwhelmed. There's always someone else a few clicks away. She advises that you check out 5 to 9 people on Match.com or any other matchmaking site, then stop and get to know one of them. Go out there and be enthusiastic and interested. The more you get to know somebody, the more you like them, she said. If you want to get lucky, you may need to expand your view of what you think you want. So, for example, Fisher has found that people on dating websites often give very specific outlines of the characteristics they need in a partner, and then connect with people who have completely different traits. It's a little like claiming you want to watch BBC documentaries and then streaming 10 old episodes of Friends. Are you sure you know what's going to make you happy? The algorithms on some of the dating apps are now taking into account what you do as well as what you say. When asked about people who complain how difficult it is to meet someone special, Dr. Fisher just sighed. We make our own luck by going to places where luck might happen. If you love opera, go to opera events. If you love art, go to events at the museum. If you care about money, go where the rich hang out. 87% of Americans will eventually marry, but you don't get there by staying home watching Westworld, she said. So what's the best place to meet a mate? When we talked about it later, Barnaby pointed out that luck comes more from the strength of the connections than from the power of the numbers. You're more likely to find love among the 125 people at a friend's wedding than among 20,000 fellow revelers at a football game. If you want to connect to a potential partner, strike up a conversation over the dessert buffet rather than at the stadium hot dog stand. Confidence, a positive mindset, and an openness to possibility help make you lucky in love. From his studies across many fields, Barnaby found that you're most likely to get lucky when you pay attention to where you'll find the best opportunities. And that means the best opportunities for you. Remember the idea Barnaby described earlier of ideal free distribution? Animals have a natural tendency to aggregate in certain areas where they're most likely to find food and mates. In human terms, that's called happy hour at a bar. They seem to know quite naturally where to gather relative to the resources available. If there's an area of thick vegetation good for grazing, you'll find lots of, say, deer there, and fewer deer in the less dense area across the field. That way, there's plenty for everybody. Once too many deer are gathered in the same place, some will, reasonably enough, drift to another spot. Once again, there's enough for everyone. It helps to remember that in the dating world, there's enough for everyone, too. Think about what advantages you have and what your peers are doing, and then you can reasonably figure out how to make your own luck. You can go to the bar where all the coolest, richest, and sexiest people hang out, because that's where you have the best chance of meeting a cool, rich, and sexy Mr. or Ms. Right. But if everyone else is gathering there, too, then you're all competing for the same, well, resources. Where there is more opportunity, there is a greater density of competitors. If you're the kind of person who can compete in that setting, then step right up and order a martini. But if you don't stand out amid the noise, maybe you have a better chance of getting lucky, in meeting someone, that is, at the quieter coffee shop down the block. To be lucky in love, you need to know what you're aiming for, and that's not the same for everyone. If you want a very specific type of mate, demand and supply might not match. Sorry, nothing is perfect. To return to Barnaby's animal analogy for a moment, some get lucky by grazing on grass and others by browsing on trees, and setting the right target sets you up for subsequent luck. If you don't have the right target, you miss out on the luck. Dr. Fisher herself got married once when she was young, but jettisoned that relationship quickly and has never married again. She spent 30 years in a close, loving relationship with a man considerably older than she was, and after his death, she had several other involvements. Now she's attached to a new man and working out whether it's the perfect fit. In a little aside, she whispered that she likes him a lot, but they don't share all the same interests. Was the problem a deal breaker, or just one of those things that you have to manage for a happy relationship? Like everyone else, Dr. Fisher is trying to figure out what would make her feel lucky in love. She contends that we have evolved with three kinds of love: sex drive, romantic love, and attachment to a partner. All have a biological basis. The evolutionary reason for a sex drive is obvious, since evolution can't happen without it. Dr. Fisher said attachment is also an innate drive that evolved so you can tolerate each other long enough to raise a child. Ah, but what about romantic love, the stuff of myth and legend and Shakespeare's best plays? Dr. Fisher says it's also a basic drive. She and two colleagues once did an experiment where they put people who were intensely in love into fMRI scanners to study their brain function. They concluded that the neurochemical dopamine is closely connected to romantic love. There's a little factory in the base of the brain that makes dopamine, and it's right next to the regions that regulate thirst and hunger. Those are very basic drives. You don't get rid of them, Dr. Fisher told us. Romantic love, all that dopamine, may be an even more powerful drive than sex or attachment. Dr. Fisher pointed out that you don't kill yourself because somebody won't have sex with you. But the end of a great romance can lead to rage and anger and even suicide. Call it the Romeo and Juliet syndrome. Thus, with a kiss, I die. In the throes of romantic love, you readily overlook the flaws of your partner because the brain creates a happy blur of positive illusion. When the romance dwindles, you notice more, and sometimes that's when you stop feeling so lucky. Hello, Troy and his supermodel Helen. Dr. Fisher thinks that maintaining some of those positive illusions, or at least focusing on what you like in the person rather than what you don't, is part of what keeps you feeling lucky into the attachment stage. Just ask Phoebe from Iowa. The one little hitch to being lucky in love is that the three systems, romance, sex, and attachment, don't always point in the same direction. You can snuggle in bed next to the person to whom you're deeply attached and still feel a wild sex drive for somebody else. There's always a committee meeting going on in your head, said Dr. Fisher. Around the world and across all cultures, the 7-year itch turns out to be more like the 4-year itch. Biology seems to have programmed couples to stay together long enough to raise a child out of infancy. And then evolution prefers we have a new partner for genetic diversity. Yes, we can fight it, but as the poet Lord Byron railed in his epic Don Juan, how the devil is it that fresh features have such a charm for us poor human creatures? A man I've known since he was a rakish bachelor is now happily married with 2 grown children, an expansive house in Santa Monica, and a ranch in Colorado. Did I say happily married? He had his first affair when his wife got pregnant with their oldest child, and since then he's had a new romance every couple of years. I haven't kept up recently. He has maintained a charade of fidelity over the years, claiming he never wanted to hurt his wife. But everybody else knew what he was up to, and since his wife seems reasonably perceptive, best guess is that she likes her homes, her children, and her comfy life. And in the grand tradition of rich men's wives everywhere, she's happy to look the other way. She has the attachment part of her husband's love and won't worry where the sex drive wanders. Is she lucky in love? I wouldn't trade places with her, though she does have some excellent jewelry. Thinking about Mick Jagger and Phoebe and my philandering friend, I wondered what scorecard made me so certain that Ron and I were lucky in love. On Dr. Fisher's scale, I could currently check romance, sex, and attachment, so 3 for 3 seemed as lucky as you get. But it was important to look at the time frame, too. Can you be lucky all the time? Over the years, we'd had small squabbles and big clashes and wasted weekends being angry instead of amorous. Our marriage wasn't always perfect. At weddings, I sometimes think that the best gift I could give the bride and groom is a note that reads, "You'll have some bad days." But nobody wants to hear that. Maybe I could just slip a message inside the Cuisinart box saying that the real secret to luck in a marriage is just deciding that you'll stay together, no matter what. Barnaby and I had arranged to talk with Duke psychologist and behavioral economist Dan Ariely, famous for his research into the irrational ways that people behave. If you've ever spent 20 minutes online looking for the cheapest price on Rice Krispies and then gone out for a fancy dinner, you know what he means by irrational. With all Dr. Ariely's research, I wondered if he'd come up with any insights on the rational way to get lucky in love. You bet he had. We have to get out of the mindset of thinking you're looking for the best person in the world, because the best person in the world doesn't exist and looking is futile, he said bluntly. At some point you say, this person is wonderful. Maybe somebody out there is more wonderful, but I don't want to keep searching. Uh-oh. Dr. Ariely is a much-admired professor, but that sounded a lot like settling. But Dr. Ariely was, of course, coming at this from a very rational perspective. He and Barnaby began discussing a classic example economists use that has been dubbed the secretary problem, and is simply a way of looking at how you know when to stop any search. The formula is that an executive needs to hire an assistant, so he begins interviewing and looking for the right person. He wants someone terrific, but every day that he doesn't have an assistant is a problem and comes with its own cost. Nobody to answer the phone. The question is, when should he stop the search and hire someone, even if the person isn't perfect? The optimal solution is to figure out the distribution of people in the pool, and once you recognize it, take the first person who gets over that threshold, he told us. The same is true for finding the right person to marry. If you believe in true love, you may not want to sign on with Prince or Princess OK when Prince Perfect may be just around the corner. But Dr. Ariely thinks having a plan is the best way to get lucky in love. Even in the most emotional of realms, you can't rely on your emotions. Following our instincts in love, or work, or finance, or buying Rice Krispies, doesn't always lead to the best rational choice. If you're single and want to get lucky in love, you can't just hope for love to land. You need a strategy. And hope is not a strategy, as one executive I know is fond of saying. As we chatted, Dr. Ariely compared dating to investing in the stock market. You think you have a rational approach, but then something changes. The Dow is down by 200. And you panic and let the emotions of a moment change your plan. To be lucky in love or the stock market, you don't want to let your nature run the show, he said. But then he stopped himself to point out one big difference between stocks and people. When you choose a stock, the stock doesn't change. But the moment you choose a person, the relationship alters. You make luck when you decide that you're going to be here for a long time, so let's explore and figure out what works, said Dr. Ariely. A relationship gets better when you invest in it. The commitment creates new opportunities. To be lucky in love, you need to replace the squirm-inducing fear of settling with the exciting idea of investing. Put time and effort and trust and love into a person, and you get huge dividends. It occurred to me that Ron and I had followed that route. We were committed to each other and trusted the other one to hang around, no matter what. So we could explore and try things, cutting out the ones that didn't work and continuing with what did. If we're going to be here for a long time, whatever I want for myself is also what I want for you, Dr. Ariely said. And that's how you make luck. We can try out new things together and not worry that something won't work. Staying isn't always the right choice. There are plenty of situations of emotional abuse or violence or alcoholism or other damaging behavior where the only way to get lucky is to leave. But in more benign circumstances, Dr. Ariely points out that it's not the choosing that matters so much as what you do once the choice is made. Many behavioral psychologists have shown that once we make a decision, our brains kick in to prove that we've made the best choice. In various popular experiments, researchers have given volunteers small items, such as a mug or a pen, and once it was officially theirs, they could trade it. But few did. Just possessing it made them like it more. And same for partners. In one survey of 1,100 people that Helen Fisher oversaw, 86% said that they would marry the same person over again. Ariely offered the example of living in an apartment where you have a short-term lease that both you and the landlord have to keep agreeing to renew. If you're deciding every day whether to extend the lease, you won't paint or buy flowers. You'll always be looking at other options, he said. It was a good point on so many levels. When Ron and I were deciding whether we wanted to leave our suburban home and move to Manhattan, I suggested that we rent a small apartment and try it out. If we liked city life, we would take the next step. Ron didn't like the idea. He thought it would be a completely different experience if we bought a place and made it ours and felt committed. And so that's what we did. We bought a tiny apartment that was in terrible shape and then lovingly renovated it. I chose the paint colors and the bathroom fixtures and the new kitchen cabinets, and Ron made sure the wiring was as he wanted and the outlets were in the right places and, well, something about coaxial cable. I didn't have to understand everything. But the point is, after we invested our time and attention, we loved that little apartment way beyond reason. I'm sure there are people who can get a short-term rental and still decide to paint and buy fresh flowers and re-caulk the bathtub. But somehow, it's easier when you know you'll be sticking around. Barnaby suggested we get together with a professor named Paul Zak, who teaches at the Claremont Graduate University and started their Center for Neuroeconomics Studies. He also happens to appear on a lot of TV shows where he's generally called Dr. Love. How could I say no to Dr. Love? As we waited in the lobby of the Cornell Club, Barnaby told me that Dr. Zak's research largely focused on how the neurochemical oxytocin was linked with trust, love, and morality. It sounded like a big role for a small molecule. Then Barnaby leaned over and whispered that he should warn me that Dr. Love liked to... Before he could finish, Dr. Love himself came in, and Barnaby introduced us. "Hi, I like to hug," Dr. Zak said, practically finishing Barnaby's sentence. Since he's tall and handsome, with the looks of an archetypal soap opera star, a hug seemed like a perfectly good greeting. But as we sat down, I asked him what that was all about. "A hug releases oxytocin, which helps people open up," he said. "The first time I tried hugging everyone at a meeting, I found people smiled and shared a lot more with me." I pointed out that the quick hug didn't really feel life-changing. Dr. Zak smiled. "Oxytocin is made in 1 second and lasts in the brain about 20 minutes. Dr. Zak is on a mission to prove that our bodies know when we're lucky in love, even if our conscious brains aren't quite so smart. For the ABC TV show The Bachelor, he set up experiments for the 2016 season, checking the brain activity of Bachelor Ben and 6 of the women he was meeting. The tests looked at how they reacted to each other's smells, the levels of oxytocin release, and physiological syncing, measured by heart rate variability and how closely their rhythms matched. The experiments were done in a spick-and-span white room stocked with complicated-looking machines and test tubes and beakers filled with colored liquids, a set decorator's idea of a research lab. Some wondered if the experiments were as faux as the colored beakers. A bachelorette named Olivia emerged as the clear winner in all 3 tests, but Ben proposed to a woman named Lauren B. in the end. Dr. Zak is convinced the research has validity, though the bachelor may have been the wrong venue for showing it off. The physiological responses that interest Dr. Zak definitely have a role in making us lucky in love. The ancient poets who thought of the heart as the source of love weren't completely wrong. Our bodies send us love signals. Psychologists say that if you want somebody to get excited about you, do something scary with them on a first date. Go rock climbing or midnight skiing or take a spin on a roller coaster. The fancy name is misattribution of arousal, meaning your brain gets mixed up about what is causing you to feel exhilarated. If you're on a roller coaster and screaming in excitement, your brain may attribute some of the thrill to the guy who's sitting next to you. Adventures get you aroused and make you feel connected to the other person. I used to call a very close friend of mine whenever Ron and I hit a bump in our relationship, and she would repeatedly listen and give advice. But then she started to notice a pattern. One time when I was worried and wanted to talk, she refused to get concerned. "You two will just have sex or take a hike or go to a museum, and then everything will be okay again," she said. It made me laugh, so I repeated it to Ron, and I have to admit that it's been our mantra ever since. There's nothing that doesn't get better for us with sex, a hike, or a museum. Those happen to be things Ron and I like anyway, and any couple can find their own lucky activities. All the neurochemicals